Questions before I start? Okay. Quickly, the plan for the course is given here. And next week I'm going to talk about SAGE for the whole hour, but with particular emphasis on modular forms. And then I'll talk about HECC operators on modular forms on Wednesday. And I'll talk about fast computation of Bernoulli numbers on Friday. Then the week after that will be modular symbols week. So it'll be a whole week. We learn all about modular symbols of wave two. Then the week after that, I'll talk about Dirichlet characters and Eisenstein series. And then on the Friday of that week, Chuck is going to give a talk on topological modular forms in here. And then the following week, I'll talk about dimension formulas, some of which have no proof written down. So be a potential thing that somebody could do, since nobody's ever written down proofs of some of these formulas. It would be a good project. Then I'll talk about linear algebra for a while, for three lectures. So I'll tell you everything I know about linear algebra. And then I'll talk more about SAGE. I'll have a second lecture on SAGE. And finally, next after that, I'll have a group of four lectures on higher weight modular symbols. So these are analogs of modular symbols that were introduced by Loïc Merel in the context of computing modular forms of weight greater than 2. And you can also prove all kinds of neat rationality results for special values of L functions from this point of view that Shimura had proved from a different point of view earlier. But this point of view gives you much more computational access to these special values. Then I'll give a lecture on the Apkin-Lehner-Lee theory of new forms. I won't prove everything, but I'll at least state the theorems and explain what they mean. Computating is a typo, but the next lecture after that will be about computing and storing, which is actually a really tricky thing, systems of eigenvalues. So these are coefficients of modular forms. If you just store them in a naive way, you end up wasting vast amounts of space, and John Kimono and I came up with a really much, much more compact way to store eigenvalues. Then finally, I'll give a lecture on sort of three topics, computing special values of L functions using modular symbols. That was, in fact, the reason modular symbols was first introduced, was to compute special values of L functions. Brian Birch introduced them in the 60s in the context of investigating his conjecture with Swinnerton-Dyer. Then there'll be a holiday. Then I'll talk about the Sturm bound. I'll probably even prove it. And then I'll talk about Serre's conjectures during the very last day of class. Okay, so that's an overview of the rest of the course in detail. All right, now onto the structure theorem. So the structure theorem really follows from just a few basic things and the valence formula. And the valence formula is the following. So fix F to be the standard fundamental domain in the upper half plane for the action of SL2z. So here you have I, here you have rho, which is e to the 2 pi I over 3. This is a unit circle right here. And despite the sloppiness, this is a nice square fundamental domain right here. And the valence formula is just the following. Suppose you have an F in MK SL2Z, a level 1 weight K modular form, then the following formula is satisfied. The order of vanishing of F at infinity, this just means look at the Q expansion of F at infinity, and the order of vanishing is the number of powers of Q that divide the Q expansion, plus 1 half word IF. Here, this is just as in complex analysis, it's the largest power of Z minus I that divides F. That is, F over Z minus I to that power is holomorphic, and then any larger power wouldn't be holomorphic. If you like, you take the Taylor expansion of F about I, and the order of vanishing is literally the first exponent that appears in the Taylor expansion. Plus a third times the order of vanishing at rho of f, plus the sum over all the other points in here, w and f star. The sum just means you omit the ones I've already mentioned of the order of vanishing at w of f. This is equal to k over 12. Doesn't matter what your f is, let's say f is non-zero. Probably isn't true if f is zero, since one side would be infinity. I should say f is, oh, that's what it says in the theorem here. So you have a non-zero f in here, and then this formula is satisfied. And if you look at Sarah's A Course in Arithmetic, he spends three pages using the residue theorem and drawing little arcs that go around various points and arrives at this statement about the order vanishing of this function at various points. And he makes a remark that if you put a complex structure on the upper half plane, then you could derive this from standard facts about Riemann surfaces. I'm not going to give any proof at this point. So the proof, see Sarah's book. The Course in Arithmetic. What I am going to do is show you how to use this to prove, or to really completely understand the structure, at least as an algebra, of level one modular forms. Okay, see, my notes have some stuff about exact sequences. In particular, this is, I don't think I need to say too much about this, just bringing this back to the context of modular forms a little more. MK, I just mean MK SL2Z. I'm not going to talk about any other groups besides SL2Z today, so I'll just omit the SL2Z from the notation. Inside of here you have SK, and you might wonder what the co-kernel of this map is from SK to MK. Is there a natural map from SK to MK that has, well, sorry, from MK to something else that has kernel SK? And the answer is yes, certainly. You just take an element of MK and evaluate it at infinity. By which I mean consider its Q expansion at infinity and take the constant term. Or take the limit as z goes to I infinity of f of z. And you get a complex number. And so long as MK is non-zero, this map is surjective. And its kernel is exactly the modular forms that vanish at infinity, which is just the definition of SK. So you have an exact sequence like this for K greater than or equal to 4 and even, or K equal to 0. When this is 0, SK is 0, MK has dimension 1, it's just the constants, and that's the same as C. So that's just a nice thing to write down so you understand MK a little bit better. Another way to write this is MK is the direct sum of SK with the subspace spanned by GK, where GK was the Eisenstein series I mentioned before, which you get completely explicitly, you're summing over 1 over AZ, or 1 over NZ plus M to the power of K. I'll sort of allude to this a few times, but just keep this in mind. SK has codimension 1 inside of MK. The reason is because SK is simply the kernel of the map from MK to the complexes given by sending a modular form to its value at infinity. Okay, any questions? Okay. I'll just use that a little bit later. Okay, finally, here's a nice application of the residue theorem. Or rather, of the valence formula that comes from the residue theorem. So here's a proposition. K is less than 0, so that implies MK equals 0. And for K equal to 2, you also have MK, that's right, M2 equals 0. Okay, so all you do to see this is, suppose you have an f, say, of negative weight, then it's a holomorphic function on the upper half plane. So each of the terms here is greater than or equal to 0. It's the order of vanishing of a function, a holomorphic function at a point. You add them all up, and you get a negative number divided by 12. So you have a non-negative number equals a negative number. Contradiction, unless your f was 0, then this valence formula wouldn't have applied. So that's why the first thing is true. The second one takes a little bit of thought. Suppose our f has weight 2. Well, each of these is an integer. So, because remember, SL2z has 1, 1, 0, 1 in it, so even at infinity, the order of vanishing is an integer. So now we're assuming k equals 2. then each of these is an integer, and it's supposed, the sum is supposed to add up to 2 over 12, which is 1/6. Is there any way, well, if this were positive, then you'd already exceed a 6. If any of those were non-zero, you'd exceed a 6. Is there any way to add some multiple of a half plus a multiple of a third to get a 6? Not going to happen, because already each of these is too big. So here also, there are no modular forms. Or negative weight, or for weight 2, and level 1. By the way, of course, this isn't true if you replace SL2z by a subgroup, like gamma 0 of n or gamma 1 of n. Then you do have modular forms of, say, weight 2. We won't have negative weight. You certainly have weight 1, though. Okay, now here's an important theorem that we will use in a moment to prove the structure theorem. And that's the following. If you take the function, or the modular form of weight 12 delta that I talked about before, that I introduced last time, then you get a map from modular forms of weight k minus 12 to modular forms of weight k. And this is for any k. And the map is simply, it's not a complicated map, it's just multiplication by delta. So you take your form, it's a function, you multiply it by delta, and you get another function. If your original function is a modular form of weight k minus 12, the new function is a modular form of weight k, because the weights add. And this will vanish at infinity, because delta vanishes at infinity, and f is holomorphic at infinity. So you get a well-defined map like this, and it's certainly injective, because delta isn't zero. Let's see, maybe that's not the best argument, but so what do I argue? It's not identically zero. So I'm going to have to prove it. Well, I'll just pass over that without seeing more. But it's injective, and well, I'll prove it has that you can divide by delta and get an out of that, which will certainly imply injective, and will in fact imply surjective. So, proof. So what I'm proving is that, in fact, this map is an isomorphism. And what I'll do is I'll take an element of sk, I'll divide it by delta, and show you that you get an element of mk minus 12. So suppose g is in sk. Now, we want to consider g divided by delta. Now, this is a modular function. Since delta is not identically zero, this is a neuromorphic function on the upper half plane. It's modular of weight, the difference of the two weights, since, well, 1 over delta, for example, is a modular function of weight minus 12. So you can think of this as multiplying g by 1 over delta. This quotient is a modular function, a meromorphic function on the upper half plane that transforms in the right way under SL2z to be a modular function of weight, the weight of g, minus the weight of delta. So this is a modular function of weight, the weight of g, which is k, minus 12. And now what we need to verify is that it's holomorphic on the upper half plane and at infinity. So on the upper half plane, it's holomorphic because, remember, the only zero that delta has is at infinity. The argument I gave for that is that delta at a point in the upper half plane is the discriminant of the Weierstrass equation of an elliptic curve corresponding to that point in the upper half plane. And discriminants of Weierstrass equations of elliptic curves are non-zero. You could also argue directly using the valence formula and the expression for delta in terms of g4 and g6 that delta doesn't vanish anywhere in the upper half plane. But I like to think about it more as delta is a discriminant of something. It's a discriminant and it's non-zero. So this doesn't vanish anywhere in the upper half plane. So this quotient is a holomorphic function on the upper half plane. So what happens at infinity?
a non-rhetorical question. Yes?
You have to have a zero because in the way that you care it goes.
Right.
One.
So this thing vanishes at infinity. Now, we know it vanishes at infinity because we looked at the linear combination of G4 and G6 and saw that it vanished at infinity. Now, what is the order of vanishing at infinity? We haven't addressed that yet. But you can figure that out using this. So what's the order of vanishing of delta at infinity?
It's going to be 1.
1, you're right, because the order of vanishing at infinity plus this stuff, which is all 0, is equal to 12 over 12, which is 1. Excellent. This vanishes to order 1 at infinity. G, being a cusp form, vanishes to order greater than or equal to 1 at infinity. So the zeros cancel, and this is holomorphic also at infinity. Therefore, this quotient is in nk minus 12. It's a meromorphic function on the upper half plane that transforms in the right way, that is in fact holomorphic everywhere. So this is in nk minus 12. So this relation between weight k minus 12 and weight k, and the fact that cusp forms really just, and you have this direct sum decomposition, tells us that at least we should expect to be able to figure out what all the modular forms spaces are of level 1 once we understand the ones up to weight sort of 12 or 14 or something like that. Once we understand the first few, we should be able to build up everything else just by multiplying by delta. Okay, any questions? So already you know that you can make everything of weight k just by taking everything of weight k minus 12 and multiplying it all by delta. That will give you the entire cuspidal subspace of weight k, and then you just throw in gk, and you'll get everything. Okay, so that's great. I've now proved to you that you can get everything of weight k from the first few weights just by multiplying by delta and throwing in a gk at each step. And my goal is to prove right now, by trying to prove the structure theorem, which is the assertion that G4 and G6 generate everything. I'm going to leave this up because I'm going to use it so much. C adjoin G4 and G6, you get the module, the graded algebra of all modular forms of level 1. That's what we're proving right now,
which we've almost proved.
Okay, the next thing is to figure out exactly what happens for the weights up to 14. And we're going to get that from this and observations I've made so far. And the statement is for k equal to 0, 4, 6, 8, 10, and 12. 12, no, 14, sorry. 14, we have that say that dimension of mk is equal to 1. And since you know an element in there, this is just saying that mk is equal to the span over c of gk, except when k equals 0 when it's the constants. So for c equal to 0. And of course, this implies no SK equals 0 for each of these. Because remember, SK has codimension 1 in MK, and MK has dimension 1 for all of these, therefore SK has dimension 0. So here's why. Okay, the first observation is that if K is less than or equal to 10, then the dimension of MK. The dimension of SK is 0. The reason is because if SK for K less than or equal to 10 had dimension bigger than 0, then mk minus 12, that is n sub something negative, would have positive dimension. We already know there's no modular forms of negative weight. So that eliminates, so that's true. This is just because of that isomorphism right there. Since no modular forms of negative weight. Okay, let's see. Do I prove M2? Yeah, I prove that M2 has dimension 0 just a second ago. Since M2 has dimension 0, that tells us that if you add 12 to that, then the cuspidal subspace for M14 is also trivial. So that's exactly what I'm saying here. Actually, I can say equivalently, actually, i.e. So similarly, you get what I said here for k equal to 14 using M2 has dimension 0. So S14 has dimension the same as the dimension of M2, which is 0, as I remarked before. Remember, that was the argument where I said if you had something of weight 2, then you'd have to have these adding up to 1/6. But there's no way to find an integer linear combination of a half and a third because you're a sixth for completely trivial reasons. So this also has dimension 0. But the dimension of S14 is 1 less than the dimension of M14, so that's the claim right there. So I guess I've proved this. Right, any questions about this? Again, this, you're figuring out exactly what the small mk are by using that. You could, you know, if one of these were big, then you could divide by delta, and you'd get that space of modular forms of negative weight would also be big. But we know they're all 0 by the valence formula. You don't get modular forms of negative weight because they'd have to have poles. And modular forms, by definition, don't have poles. There are certainly modular functions are of negative weight. Remember, modular function, there's no condition of polymorphicity. You could take delta and, you know, consider 1 over delta. That's a modular function of weight minus 12. It's not a modular form. It has a pole at infinity. It would satisfy a formula like this, but it's just not a modular form. Okay, so we're almost done. We now completely understand all of the spaces M sub k for k up to 14. And that puts us in, actually, well, for k up to 14, I haven't completely explained what happens with 12, but again, you can use this isomorphism and see that at least the cuspidal subspace is isomorphic to constants. So for 12, the dimension has to be 1. I'll come back to that. But we basically understand everything's small, and you have this which allows you to do an induction. So I'm going to be able to tell you about all the spaces of level 1 and prove this. I have to be able to do that. At this point. So I'll leave this up here because it's important. And now, just a corollary. It's kind of a warm up. I want to tell you about the structure of the space. So first I'll tell you its dimension. The dimension, and you get it from this, of course, the dimension of mk is, it's roughly k over 12, the floor of k over 12. But more precisely, it's 0, of course, if k is odd. And it's the floor of k over 12 when k is 2 mod 12. And it's the floor of k over 12 plus 1 otherwise. So k is not 2 mod 12, but it's k is even. Okay, and the way you prove this, well, notice that this function is periodic of period 12. So all you need to do is check that this works for k up to, 14. Or at least check that it works for 12 different residue classes of k modulo 12. And it works for all the odd ones. And for the even ones, we just checked it here. So it works, and notice that whenever you increase, if you increase k by 12, you increase the dimension of mk by 1, just because of this isomorphism and the fact that sk has codimension 1 inside of mk. So this has to be true.
Okay, any questions about that? So that's a dimension formula.
So whenever you think about, you know, if I say, quick, give me a guess at what the dimension of m sub 2006 is. You can immediately say, well, it's about, you know, 180, something like that. It's a little bit less than a tenth of the number, because you're dividing by 12. Okay, so you don't take anything else away today, take away at least that. Dimension of level 1 forms, it's about k over 12. Okay, now I'm going to prove this theorem. Okay, we will prove it by induction on k. K is an integer, might as well assume it's even. And we're going to prove this statement, which more precisely, we're going to prove that mk is equal to the span, well, has as a basis. As basis, which is a little bit, maybe a little bit stronger than what I wrote there, has basis the modular forms g4 to the a times g6 to the b, such that a and b, such that a and b run through integers of 4a and 6b equal to k, and of course a and b are both greater than or equal to 0. So I'll prove this. And this is slightly stronger than what I've been telling you I would prove, because this says that, in fact, there are no relations between the forms like this. So not only do they span, they give a basis. They're linearly independent. I will prove that. Okay, first, if k is less than or equal to 12, I've already proved this. Because for k less than or equal to 12, there is just one representation. I think there's just one representation like this, and I've already showed you in each case that the appropriate g works, because the dimension is small. It's always 1. So it's k less than or equal to 12 or 14, you know this. So we won't need to use the valence formula anymore for this proof.
Do we know if k is equal to 12?
So we know the dimension, and g4, I don't think I'll use it for, I think I'll just use it for k less than or equal to 10 and 14 in the induction. Because the proof is exactly, I think, going to work for k equal to 12. So, so I won't need it for 12. So the first, I have to prove two things. One, that they span, and two, that they're independent. So show they span, you have to take an element, well, we will take an element of mk, consider, or actually let f tend to be an element of mk. I remember exactly how I did this. Oh, that's nice. Okay, so now take any a, b, such that 4a plus 6b is equal to k. So I'm assuming k is even, and hence such an a and a b exist. As long as k is at least, I mean, it's not true if k is 2, but k is not 2, so. So at this point, k is greater than or equal to, it's either 12 or greater than 14, and even. So you can always write it as something times a plus something times b. Completely elementary, I won't say more about that. So you find some a and b, which that's true. And now consider the form g, which is equal to g4 to the power of a times g6 to the power of b, which is certainly in Mk. It's non-zero, because think about the Q expansions of each of these. They're Q expansions, they have one as their, or they have a non-zero constant term. And when you multiply, you take some power, you still have a non-zero constant term. When you multiply, you have a non-zero constant term. This product is certainly non-zero. Moreover, it's non-zero at infinity. G at infinity is not equal to zero, so it's a non-zero constant term. So when I write non-zero constant term, I mean since both of these have non-zero constant terms, since the product has a non-zero constant term. And power, if you multiply it together, two power series of non-zero constant term, the product also has that property. So g is not zero at infinity. Now, f is something at infinity, and there must be some complex number which I call alpha in the notes, so that f minus alpha g is zero at infinity. You know, just take whatever f is at infinity, and take whatever g is at infinity, and just take alpha to be what f is at infinity, divided by what g is at infinity. Just take alpha to be f infinity over g of infinity, right? Because then this is f of infinity minus f of infinity divided by g of infinity times g of infinity, so that's just zero. Okay, so we can subtract off a scalar multiple of g from f, and we get a cusp form. So f minus alpha g is a cusp form. But now you can divide f minus alpha g by delta using the isomorphism over here. And the result will be a modular form of weight smaller, hence you're in luck, as far as induction goes, by theorem over here. F minus alpha g divided by delta is a modular form of weight k minus 12. But by induction, you know that the modular forms of weight k minus 12, they have as basis the g4 to the a times g6 to the b's, where 4a plus 6b equals k minus 12. So this is equal to, you know, the direct sum of g4 to some power times g6 to some other power. So that tells you that f minus alpha g is equal to delta times some polynomial in the g4 and g6. But delta itself is a polynomial in g4 and g6. It's just g4 cubed times something minus g6 squared times something. And g, little g, that's certainly a polynomial in g4 and g6. Because look, we chose it to be one of them. So this f is equal to delta times some element of mk minus 12, which by induction is a polynomial of g4 and g6, plus alpha times g4 to the a, g6 to the b. And that tells us that f is a polynomial in the g4 and g6. This is a polynomial in g4 and g6. And also, if you want to worry about the exponents, certainly 4a plus 6b is k here, and here you get to add 12 to the, this, well, it just works out right if you look at what happens. So f is a polynomial in g4 g6. So I've proved to you now that every modular form of level 1 is a polynomial in g4 and g6. You can compute all the modular forms of level 1 just by writing down g4 and g6, taking products. Okay? So that's the first half of what I wanted to prove, a span. And now just a little observation at the end. G4 and G6 are linearly independent. And here's why.
algebraically independent, not linearly independent. So for this, say you have some polynomial in G4 and G6, some non-zero polynomial that's equal, a polynomial, some polynomial x and y with x and y as some things, and this is equal to zero. So I'm assuming that it's a homogeneous where, say, the x has weight 4 and the y has weight 6. In other words, suppose you had some linear combination of g4 to the a plus g6 to the b, where 4a plus 6b equals k, and that was equal to 0. But the linear combination had non-zero coefficients. Well, here's a trick. If you had that, if this is equal to 0, that is, if the g4 to the a times g6 to the b are not linearly independent, then you could just multiply by a suitable power of them so that k is equal to, is k is congruent to 0 mod 12. So, if you multiply by a power of g4, you're increasing the weight here by 4 each time, or by a multiple of 4. If you multiply by a power of 6, you're increasing the weight by a multiple of 6. You can certainly take any even positive integer and multiply it, add 4s to it and add 6s to it to eventually get something that's divisible by 12. Just an elementary observation about numbers. So without loss, you can assume that here k is congruent to 0 mod 12. Assume without loss that k is congruent to 0 mod 12. And now, take your relation f of g4, g6, and just divide the whole thing by g6 to the power of k over 12. Since k is divisible by 12, this exponent here is an integer, and what's the weight of g6 to the power of k over 12? It's k over 2. Wait, I'm a little confused suddenly. Why would I divide by that? So what I want to do is rewrite this as a single polynomial in g4 cubed over g6 squared. I don't want to use g for the name of that polynomial, called h. So I just want to rewrite it that way. It seems like they're divided by the wrong. This has some weight k. I want to divide by something of weight k, because that would have weight 0. So that has to be wrong. Should put a 6 here. Okay, what is the weight of g6 to the k over 6? That's weight k. This thing on the top, by hypothesis, had weight k. K congruent to 0 mod 6. So the quotient has weight 0. And when you think about this homogeneous polynomial and to look at it monomial by monomial, you end up getting a polynomial in g4 cubed over g6 squared. And that's equal to 0. This is a weight 0 So this is equal to 0. So this function here is the root of a polynomial. G4 cubed over g6 squared is a constant, which tells you that g4 cubed is a constant multiple of g6 squared. And that's not the case because, for example, delta is not 0. If you take that constant multiple, we actually took whatever the constant multiple would have to be, and we took that difference in order to construct delta. So there's no way that g4 cubed over g6 squared is a constant. Otherwise, delta would be 0 everywhere, and delta isn't 0. So this would imply that this is a constant, which is a contradiction. And that tells you that there can't be a dependence. But actually, I think I'll...
That's enough. You could also do this elementary number theory. I mean, I gave you a dimension formula for the space MK, which I proved. And all you have to do is show that the set of integers 4AB such that 4A, sorry, the set of pairs of integers AB such that 4A plus 6B equals K, that set has the same cardinality as the dimension. And that would also prove independence just by that. But this is a nice way as well. Okay, so now I will show you the Victor Miller basis. So we've now proved that level 1 modular forms are generated by G4 and G6. And now the next question, which is alumni in Victor Miller's PhD thesis, just tells you what, so if you take, for a given weight, write down these things, G4 to the A, G6 to the B, where 4A plus 6B equals K, you've written down a basis for MK. But there are other possible bases that you might write down. For example, I mean, this is pretty natural, but another one would be to take all the Q expansions of your basis and then put them in reduced row echelon form, by which I mean you take the constant term and clear the first, you know, subtract off all the constant terms from the other things in your basis. And then you have, one plus something times Q plus higher order terms, and all the other forms in your basis that start out with possibly something times Q, and so on. Then you could take the next one here and normalize it so the coefficient of Q is 1, and then subtract that off from all of the other things in your basis. And you end up with another basis where everything else starts with some multiple of Q squared plus higher order terms, multiple of Q squared plus higher order terms, and so on, where the multiple could be 0. And then if there's something with a coefficient non-zero of Q squared, and it's below what you've done already, you subtract that off. And you end up getting an echelon form basis of Q expansions for level 1. What do you get? Do you have each power occurring as the first coefficient? I mean, as a first power. So is it 1 and Q, then Q squared at the end? It's this canonical basis that you get. What is it like? And Victor Miller answered that question. So here's what Victor Miller said, slightly different than what I just said, but consider SK. SK has a basis Fi, F1 through Fd, where D is the dimension of SK, and Ai of Fj. Ai means the ith coefficient of the Q expansion of Fj. This is delta ij. And moreover, and the Q expansions of the Fi are in Z double brackets Q. Okay, so this says that there's a basis of a very nice form. And in fact, you can see an example. If you look at page 27 in the notes, there's an example of this basis for k equal to 36. Are there any extra copies of the notes? Or I guess, does anybody need a copy of the notes? Okay, I guess it doesn't matter that they're extra. But here's an example. Notice that at the beginning, it's just the identity matrix. If you look at the matrix of the coefficients of the Q expansions. And then afterwards, there's all kinds of big mysterious integers, but they are integers. So the question is, why is this true? And now I will explain that to you. So here's the argument, which is, again, due to Victor Miller. And here's what you do. You let F4 be the unique scalar multiple of G4 that has constant coefficient 1. And because you know exactly what the definition of G4 is,
This will, and you can see that all the other coefficients are integers. So this is equal to a scalar multiple of G4. Remember, G4 had these, the constant coefficient, the linear coefficient. You know it explicitly, the cubic expansion of G4 is. It involves Bernoulli numbers, for example. I kind of skipped that, and we'll talk about that a little bit later. But you know G4 so explicitly that you can tell just most of the coefficients of G4 are some of the divisors, and if you just normalize it, so the constant coefficient is 1, this is what you get. You get something with integer coefficients. And you see that just from working explicitly and looking at the power series of G4. Power series of G4 was some like stuff involving the zeta function that turned out to cancel out with some Bernoulli numbers, and then you have the sum of the divisors function. Okay, so that's F4. Just defining it to be this scalar multiple of G4, and F6 is the same thing, but for G6, 1 minus 504 Q, et cetera, and this is a scalar multiple of G6. And now, here's what you do. So, we're trying to prove something about a specific K. We have our fixed K. And we choose, there could be multiple ways of doing this, I guess. Okay, so I'll stop, but the rest of the proof is just this little chunk right here. In words, in 30 seconds, you write down a whole bunch of modular forms, G sub j, that you construct as some power of delta times the power of F4 times the power of F6. You see that the leading coefficients of the GJ are all 1 times the power of Q, and then you use them to do Gauss elimination, and you end up with exactly this statement. You end up with the FIs. So it's just a matter of doing a little number theory to understand how the exponents work. So that's how it ends. So I encourage you to read the rest of this. It's just the middle few lines on page 26. And that's all you do. It's just explicitly write these down and look at the beginning of their Q expansions. And then just do a little Gauss elimination. Okay, so I'll see you next time on Monday. And have a good weekend.